From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, capital punishment and death row. We talk with journalist David Vondrelli. His new book examines the death penalty from the points of view of men awaiting execution, their defenders and prosecutors, and the families of victims. Also today, we meet Betty Thomas, director of the new Brady Bunch movie. Before she started directing, Thomas played Sergeant Lucy Bates on the TV show Hill Street Blues. And rock and roll historian Ed Ward plays the early music of Ike Turner before he met Tina. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole has recessed the Senate again without taking a final vote on the balanced budget amendment. Supporters need only one more vote to pass it, NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole is putting off a vote on the balanced budget amendment because it's a vote he knows he will lose. As he recessed the Senate this morning, he was in a foul mood and said he would try to find one more vote. If he fails, he said, he may call for reconsideration of the issue next fall.
And I think sometime about next September might be appropriate to reconsider this whole issue. Don't want to do it too quickly, but maybe leave it out there a year. Let's see what happens as we get near the election.
Republicans had tried to win the support of Democrat Kent Conrad, who said this morning the offers were far from acceptable. Conrad had insisted upon putting the Social Security Trust Fund surpluses off limits for budget cutting. Republicans offered to do so, but not until the year 2012. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Clinton administration has announced a plan to stop food stamp fraud and trafficking. The plan sets out new criteria for retailers dealing in food stamps. Store owners who violate the program will be immediately suspended. Food stamp recipients who abuse the program will be more harshly punished. The acting secretary of the Agriculture Department says this will make sure vital food assistance reaches the needy. The government estimates it loses $1 billion a year in food stamp fraud and wastes another $1.8 billion in food stamp overpayments. Another juror has been replaced in O.J. Simpson's double murder trial. This is the fourth juror replaced since the trial began. Kitty Feldy of member station KCRW prepared this report.
Judge Lance Ito called the panel into the courtroom and told them one of their colleagues had been released for good cause. Juror number 12, an African-American courier who would often sport a bright red suit in the jury box, wore a 49ers cap the day jurors took a field trip to the murder scene. O.J. Simpson once played for that team. The juror also stared at family pictures against the judge's orders inside Simpson's home and reportedly failed to report an incident of domestic violence in his jury questionnaire. He has been replaced by an Anglo woman who works for the telephone company. There are now 8 women and 4 men on the panel, 8 blacks, 2 whites, 1 Latino, and 1 of mixed race. There are also 8 alternates left. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy from the Criminal Courthouse in Los Angeles.
The State Department says Colombia's anti-drug efforts are lackluster. A report cites weak legislation, corruption, and inefficiency. Officials say Colombia hasn't moved aggressively against the Cali drug cartel, which controls about 80% of the world's cocaine traffic. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 19 points to 3,991. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Violence erupted in Mogadishu today, right after UN peacekeepers abandoned their positions around the Somali airport. Hundreds of gunmen and looters invaded after the UN troops pulled back to a nearby seaport. Pool reporter Nathan Thomas has more from Mogadishu.
The scavenging at Mogadishu airport lasted only a few hours before armed technicals began chasing the looters out. By afternoon, faction leader Mohamed Farah Adid, accompanied by a heavily armed entourage, casually toured the airport warehouses, indicating that the all-important facility is now under his control. The Pakistani troops, now behind U.S. lines, are loading equipment and personnel on ships and should be out of Somalia sometime Thursday. Then, the final U.S. withdrawal from the port, where there is again the possibility of factional fighting. The Americans will move back to the fleet from Green Beach, where they landed less than 48 hours ago. Nathan Thomas, inside the shrinking U.S. perimeter in Mogadishu.
Reports from London say officials at the failed Barings Brothers Bank knew about a month ago about bad deals that could trigger its collapse. One report indicates that the wife of the trader who made the bad deals worked in the bank office that was supposed to monitor his activities. Meanwhile, officials in Singapore are investigating possible fraud and sabotage in the bank's collapse. Trader Nick Leeson is alleged to have lost nearly $1 billion of the bank's money by wrongly betting the stock market would rise. It fell. NASA is still waiting to see if the shuttle Endeavour will be able to lift off early tomorrow morning. Officials say a cold front headed for Cape Canaveral is expected to bring thunderstorms that could scrub the launch. It's planned for 1:37 tomorrow morning Eastern Time. Forecasters say there's only a 20% chance for good weather. Officials don't want to wait long to make a decision. They would like to avoid unnecessary fueling of the shuttle's tanks, which costs money in fuel and overtime. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Capital punishment is practiced in 37 states. New York Governor George Pataki has vowed to make his state the 38th. In Pennsylvania, where the death penalty is legal but no one has been executed since 1962, the new governor, Tom Ridge, says he intends to make sure that the death penalty exists in more than name only. And the Republican crime bill now being debated promises to make the death penalty easier to impose. My guest David Vondrely has written a new book about capital punishment from several perspectives. It's called Among the Lowest of the Dead, The Culture of Death Row. He focuses on Florida's death row and tells the stories of men who have been executed, their defenders and prosecutors, and the families of victims. Vondrely is the arts editor of The Washington Post, where he previously covered national politics. In 1979, John Spenkelink became the first person to be executed against his will in 12 years. Vondrely says the most important thing he learned from that famous Florida case is how much money, brains, and energy the death penalty could consume.
John Spenkelink was a perfect case for that because the facts of his case were not very distinguished at all. He killed another criminal in a dispute over money. He was offered a chance to plead guilty to second-degree murder, and he would have been up for parole about the time he was executed. He foolishly didn't take the deal. But his case, that simple case, took almost 6 years to get through the appeals process. The entire state of Florida was focused on it. In the last hours, you had state attorneys flying all over the country on the governor's private jet, fighting the appeals in New Orleans and in Washington, D.C., and back in Tallahassee. You had this tremendous defense team. His lead lawyer, in fact, is now the lawyer for President Clinton on the Whitewater matters, a guy named David Kendall. So top-flight legal power on both sides, fortunes being spent. What people didn't quite realize, I think, at the time was that that wasn't going to be an exception. That was going to become the rule, and you'd have these kinds of last-minute dramatic fights being fought in every one of these thousands of cases. It's filling up the courts in Florida. The state Supreme Court spends half its time on death cases, and the federal courts about half their time. It's tremendously time-consuming and money-consuming, and that turned out to be the real lesson.
Why does the death penalty consume so much time and money?
Because the courts have said that the death penalty has to be perfect. It has to make sense from case to case. It has to stand up. Who gets it has to make sense. And so that's very hard to do with cases that are not the same. They're different. Every one of these tragedies, these awful murders, is different in its own way. To try and find out what's the same and what's different in these cases takes tremendous attention from judges. And the judges and lawyers want to get it right. They don't want to be executing people willy-nilly. And the defense attorneys really believe that either there shouldn't be a death penalty or it should be held to its promises, and so they fight. These kinds of hard-fought lawsuits, as we all know, can consume years and millions of dollars, and they do.
The Republican crime bill would limit the period of time that an inmate can file a habeas corpus petition to challenge the constitutionality of their death sentence, would that make it cheaper?
If that happened, I imagine it could. The thing that people aren't telling the American public is that the federal courts have been clamping down on habeas corpus at least since 1983. For at least a dozen years, it's been very, very, very hard for a death row inmate to lodge a second or a third habeas corpus appeal. They get one bite at the apple, pretty much, one full hearing of their habeas corpus. But when there are hundreds of cases per state in the South, and there are 400 people on death row in California, over 200 in Pennsylvania and Illinois, it takes a long time. There are log jams in the courts. And so it's not that the inmates are hanging around delaying their appeals. The fact is, the inmates are likely to win. Half of all the death sentences in America are overturned on appeal. And so the inmates, they're in the driver's seat in terms of their chances. They just as soon see these things adjudicated. So the promise there that's being made by the Republican crime bill is, I think it's a pig in the poke, because these experiments with limiting habeas corpus have been going on, as I say, for over a decade without success.
You wrote that there was another big story that was the outcome of the Spenkelink execution, and that is that death rows, instead of shrinking when executions began again, they grew.
That's right. There were 134 people on death row the day Spenkelink was executed. Today in Florida, there are 349 people on death row. It's not really a death row anymore the way you think of death row, with a few grizzled guys all sitting around smoking cigarettes and trying to cheer each other up. It's more like a death town. I once counted up in the Florida Gazetteer to find out how many incorporated cities, villages, towns there were in the state of Florida that were smaller than the population of death row. It was 450.
Has the death row grown because more people are sentenced to death, or because of how slowly the people who are sentenced to death are executed?
It's both. We're sentencing a tremendous number of people to death in America, about 300 a year across the country. So it's that combination of a lot of death sentences out there, and then this very slow, deliberative, and ultimately stymied system for getting the people who are sentenced actually executed.
David Vondrelli is my guest, and he's written a new book called Among the Lowest of the Dead, The Culture of Death Row. Did you spend much time on death row when you were researching your book?
I spent a lot of time with death row inmates. Most of what I know about life on death row comes from interviewing inmates at great length, hour after hour, just asking them how they spend their time, how a typical day goes. They spend about 23 hours a day in their cells, which are the size of bathrooms. They watch TV. They play Jeopardy competitively every night. They all watch the news on the same station so that they can argue about it afterwards. Just the years drone on and on and on.
I guess TV is about the only thing that changes.
TV is...
If you want something new to talk about.
That's right. And they don't have the cable, so it's just the broadcast stations. Interestingly to me was the reaction of the prison officials to the television, because you frequently hear politicians and ordinary citizens who get really angry about the idea that these horrible people on death row, they've committed these terrible crimes, they have TVs in their cells. And so I ask a number of wardens and guards, what do you think of these TVs? And they call them electronic pacifiers, and they wouldn't live without them. One warden told me that an angry state senator had once come to him and said, you got to get the TVs out of their cells. This is terrible. We're coddling the criminals. And the warden looked at him and said, that's fine. You go in there and take them out.
So some of the wardens saw television as a way of keeping control.
It keeps control. It gives them something to do. They dread the day that they'd have to deal with those people if they had nothing to do.
Did you watch any executions?
I did watch an execution in 1991 of a murderer named Roy Allen Herridge, who was electrocuted in Old Sparky, as they call the electric chair in Florida. It was an intense experience for me. I didn't really know what to expect, although I'd talked to many people who'd witnessed. You really don't know until you do it. The procedure itself is like, it's unreal. It's like a magic trick. They strap the guy into the chair and they cover his face, and then they throw the switch and there's a little cloud of steam as the water boils off the sponges at the electrodes. And it's also sort of mysterious and almost mystical. It seems like a stunt, a magic trick. But it was in the moments before the actual execution when Herridge was being strapped in, and he was looking at the witnesses through this glass that separated us from him, and his head was going back and forth. He was scanning us sort of like a surveillance camera in a drugstore. And I found myself praying that he wouldn't pause and look right at me. Even though I knew the terrible things he'd done, I found myself really ashamed to be there watching this most intimate, humiliating, shameful moment for him. The worst thing that can be said about a man is that he's so bad he has to be killed. And there I was looking at it, and I didn't want him to know. I didn't want him to look at me and wonder who I was and why I was there.
Is he one of the people who you knew because you'd interviewed him?
I had never interviewed him. My name came up in a sort of lottery to see one, and that happened to be the one. I'd never met him.
My guest is journalist David Vondrely. He's the author of the new book, Among the Lowest of the Dead, The Culture of Death Row. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Talking about capital punishment with David Vondrely, author of Among the Lowest of the Dead. Your book isn't just about the people on death row. It's also about families of victims.
Right.
And one family that you write about, David and Wendy Nelson, were the parents of a 10-year-old girl who was murdered.
Right.
And how does the death penalty look from their point of view as survivors?
Dave and Wendy Nelson had the world by the tail, and one morning in 1980, they had that most horrible experience that can happen to parents. Their little girl was riding her bike to school, and she disappeared, and she was found dead. That was 1980. They became energized by this tragedy to defend and support the death penalty, to push for it, and also to improve just the general way that the Florida courts treat victims. Wendy in particular, has been heroic in fighting for improvements in victims' rights in Florida, and the Florida courts are better for it. She is a strong, brave woman. But no matter how hard she fought, and she got the ear of governors and senators, it didn't make one iota of difference in speeding up the process of executing her daughter's killer, a guy named Larry Mann. The years have gone by. The courts have looked at that case. It's been bounced back down to the trial level twice. It's been through the Florida Supreme Court, which has had difficulty making up its mind. The federal courts have grappled with it. They're going to celebrate what would have been Elisa Nelson's 25th birthday soon, and Larry Mann is still alive. And that story was very powerful to me. I don't want to make it sound like Wendy or Dave has given up on the death penalty. They're still strong supporters. But to see what they've gone through waiting for something that has never been delivered and may never be delivered was, to me, an indictment of the process.
Why do they feel strongly that Larry Mann, their daughter's killer, should be executed as opposed to spending life in prison?
Wendy told me that she was raised in a family that believed in the death penalty as a sort of primal justice. Take a life, you pay with your own life. And she also told me that in her work with victims, she's seen families that have had to go to parole hearings year after year, have had to live with the fear that the killer of their loved ones would be released someday, and that what she really wanted was that at some point there'd be an end to it all, and that Larry Mann would be out of her life completely. Some victims who have seen the killer executed have had that relief. One of the problems for me with the death penalty in America today is it promises an execution in hundreds and hundreds of cases, but so far only about 2 or 3% of those death sentences have been carried out in America. And so you have, for every 100 victims' families that are promised this relief, this closure, only 2 or 3 ever get it, and the other 97 are disappointed.
Well, that fact is used by both sides of the debate. One side said, so let's make it easier to execute them. And the other side says, so what's the point of this game?
And what I'm trying to say is that I've been to Florida. I've talked to everyone involved. I've looked at what they've been doing for the past 25 years. I've said, I've come to the conclusion, as most of the people who know the death penalty best have, that it's not going to get any faster, it's not fixable, because this level of perfection can't be achieved.
The level of perfection in deciding who should get it and who should not.
It's become an endless weighing and reweighing, the courts arguing back and forth among themselves and even with themselves. There's a character in the book, Doug McRae, who was on death row for 17 years. His case never got past the first level of appeals in those 17 years. The state Supreme Court, the first level of appeal, would bounce the case back to the trial court. The trial court would try and fix the problem. It would go back to the Supreme Court. They'd find another problem. It would bounce back again. Ultimately, the state Supreme Court changed its mind in that case about whether Doug McRae should live or die 7 times before his sentence was finally reduced to life in prison. 17 years, 7 changes of mind, that's all in one court. So this perfection is a long way off.
In the years that you spent writing your book about the death penalty and death row, did you feel that you went through any fundamental or surprising shifts of attitude?
On the death penalty itself, I've felt both ways through my life. I've seen crimes that seem to cry out for it, and I've been concerned about the capriciousness of it and the waste of resources involved in it. The researching and the writing of the book changed me most by really bringing home the tragedy of the whole thing, the whole violent American culture. The number of ways there are for lives to go wrong, for people to end up in that worst place on earth, death row. The number of horrible crimes that are committed, the depravities that we're capable of. And the cost that we're paying for breakdowns in social fabric. It made me much more of a social conservative than I was before, in the sense that it drove home for me the importance of family, of self-sacrifice, of community, of ties to one another. That was the real change.
Crime is being debated now in American politics. The Republican crime bill is before Congress. President Clinton signed a crime bill last year.
Mm-hmm.
What's your critique of how crime and punishment is being debated in America now?
One of the reasons I wrote this book is because I got so tired of listening to politicians in both parties give as their answer to crime the death penalty, that there'd be more death penalties and we'd get tougher on crime by having more death penalties. And I knew from my research that toughness on crime had nothing to do with the death penalty, that as I say and as others have said, that the death penalty in modern America is a mockery of justice. So a big part of it was to try, I hope that if someone goes through this book, they'll have a feeling for what the reality is, like it or hate it, and they'll be able to go back to the public debate and demand more of their political leaders, real solutions, real responses. The book doesn't begin to enumerate what those are, but they're personal, they're social, and they're technical. Here in New York City, where I am this week, the crime rate has been falling for the past 3 years. The murder rate has been dropping. All the violent crime levels have been dropping. Why is that? We need to be examining what works. New York instead is about to turn to a death penalty. And 15 years from now, I'm positive they're going to be as frustrated as the people of Florida, as the people of California, the people of Illinois, the people of Pennsylvania are right now.
When you were doing your research into death row and when you were interviewing men who were on death row, were you conscious of not wanting to be a soft touch?
Yes. I kept reminding myself that these are really bad people. And I wouldn't just stay in Stark, which is the most aptly named town in America. It's the site of the Florida State Prison. I wouldn't stay in Stark and do interview after interview after interview at the prison because I didn't want to be wrapped up in that view of the world. I would go, I would do a couple of interviews there, and then I'd leave and go talk to victims. Or I'd leave and go talk to prosecutors or people in a governor's office. Or I'd go back to the newspaper clipping files and read through the account of the crime that man I'd been talking to on death row had committed. And that was always a reality check for me, because you're sitting in a room with someone who's been on death row a long time. Their muscle tone is gone. Most of them have been pretty well broken by that experience. They've aged. They've mellowed out, most of them. And you can begin to find yourself really sympathizing with them, and that's a dangerous thing to do because the sympathy in this country does belong with the victims of crime and shouldn't leave that place.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Vondrely is the author of Among the Lowest of the Dead, The Culture of Death Row. He's the arts editor of The Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Living Language. Learn a new language at home or on the go with Living Language. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, turning a 70s TV show into a 90s hit movie. We talk with Betty Thomas about directing the Brady Bunch movie. Thomas also directed episodes of HBO's Dream On and co-starred in Hill Street Blues as Sergeant Lucy Bates. And rock and roll historian Ed Ward recalls the music of Ike Turner before he met Tina. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Senate has been recessed until tomorrow. Majority Leader Bob Dole wants to give backers of the balanced budget amendment more time to find one more vote for their measure. Otherwise, he says, it will fail.
I believe there are 66 votes for the amendment, Democrats and Republicans. We need 67, or we need 66, if there were only 99 voting.
It's not clear when the amendment may come up for a vote. Wavering Democrats have insisted on changes to the amendment to protect Social Security money from the budget acts. There are three Democrats who want to see changes in the amendment. Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota says he cannot support the measure until he's certain Social Security will be let alone.
If it is agreed that the Social Security trust funds will not be raided to balance this budget, then I've told the other side, sign me up. I'll vote in a second. And they'll have five or six other votes as well, in my judgment. But if they decide they must use Social Security trust funds, if they're going to raid that money in the Social Security trust fund to balance the operating budget deficit, then I will not vote for it.
Majority Leader Dole says he can't guarantee when a final vote on the amendment will be taken. An advocacy group for children is blasting legislation in the House of Representatives, UPI's Bill Small reports.
The president of the Children's Defense Fund, Marion Wright Edelman, pulled no punches in her assessment of the legislative proposals being passed by the Republican majority in the House of Representatives.
Children are being made to pay for a defense buildup we don't need and tax giveaways to the rich we can't afford and that they don't need. It is time for House leaders to pick on someone their own size and leave defenseless children alone.
Edelman called the Republican proposals a threat to the entire safety net under the nation's children and urged House members to reconsider. Bill Small, Washington.
An independent commission is going to review the Pentagon's list of suggested base closures. The Defense Base Closure and Realignment Commission is holding its first hearing today. State and local representatives will be given their first opportunity to challenge the list. Backers of congressional term limits have forwarded a bill to the full House of Representatives. The Judiciary Committee has voted in favor of a constitutional amendment limiting lawmakers to 12 consecutive years in each chamber. The panel rejected three other proposals, including a version that would have limited House members to a total of 6 years in office and senators to two 6-year terms. Republicans have promised to vote on the issue within the first 100 days of Congress, as part of their contract with America. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 16 points today to close at 3,994. Declining issues led advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. This is the third anniversary of Bosnia's Independence Day. Government-held parts of the republic observed the day for the first time in the midst of continued fighting. President Clinton sent a letter to the Bosnian government praising the Bosnians' bravery, but more vicious fighting has been reported. Rebel Serbs from Bosnia and Croatia, as well as rebel Muslims from the Bihać region, have renewed their assault on Bosnian government troops. UN observers report a barrage of mortar and cannon fire has forced government troops to withdraw from positions they'd held. The German High Court has ruled a Nazi war criminal cannot be sentenced because the statute of limitations on his crimes has expired. NPR's Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
The court upheld a lower court decision that a former Nazi officer cannot be imprisoned for massacring 15 Italian women and children. The lower court ruled that Wolfgang Lenig Emden was guilty of murder but could not be prosecuted because of the statute of limitations. The former Nazi second lieutenant murdered four families in the countryside north of Naples on October 13, 1943. He does not dispute the murders, but claims they were part of a necessary military operation to wipe out resistance. After the war, Leenig Emden was released from a British prisoner of war camp and settled in Germany, working as an architect under his own name. Last year, an Italian court sentenced him in absentia to life in prison. Italy is expected to initiate extradition proceedings. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
South African police have searched the home of Winnie Mandela. She's been accused of taking bribes to help a building company get a low-cost housing contract. Authorities say no arrests are imminent in the case. Mrs. Mandela is the estranged wife of South African President Nelson Mandela. She's the Deputy Minister of Arts, Culture, Science and Technology. She's now on a business trip in West Africa. The corruption allegations are the most serious so far against a member of the new South African government. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Here's a story of a lovely lady who was bringing up three very lovely girls. All of them had hair of gold, like their mother. The youngest one in curls
is the story of a man named Brady who was busy with three boys of his own.
The Brady family is back in full polyester regalia. The 90s haven't dimmed their smiles or diminished their can-do attitudes. The TV series ran on ABC from 1969 to 1974. In a moment, we'll meet the director of the new Brady Bunch movie. The movie was co-produced by Sherwood Schwartz, the creator of the Brady Bunch TV series, not to mention A Very Brady Christmas. Schwartz also created the series Gilligan's Island. When I spoke with him a few years ago, here's the question I most wanted to ask.
Maybe I'm being presumptuous here, but you strike me as someone who grew up in an urban area, Jewish, and here you are creating the prototype for what became the ultimate suburban, goyish sitcom.
So I'm told. Yes, you're talking about the white bread Brady Bunch? Look, I have trouble. My rabbi insisted that it would have been a better name, Goldstein's Island. What's wrong with that? Or the Bernstein Bunch, for that matter.
And why didn't you write the Bernstein Bunch?
I must say, above all, I feel I am commercial in the sense that I like my work to appeal to many people. And that's my satisfaction. So to aim at the biggest, broadest base of audience, you're better off doing the Brady Bunch than the Bernstein Bunch.
Sherwood Schwartz's commercial instincts are still paying off. The Brady Bunch movie was number one at the box office last weekend. The director of the film is Betty Thomas. She started her TV career as an actress on Hill Street Blues in the role of Lucy Bates. Then she moved into the director's chair, working on such TV series as Doogie Howser, Midnight Caller, and Dream On.
Betty Thomas, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
This should be interesting. You, the director of the Brady Bunch movie, I understand, used to not watch the series when it was on, and neither did I, your interviewer.
Oh, great.
So I've since seen some episodes and saw your movie, but what were you doing when the series was on that caused you to not watch it?
I guess I was finishing college, probably. Yeah, I was in college anyway.
How did the series look to you now? Did it look like, did it look funny? Did it look silly?
No, it probably looked the same way it looked to you, Terry. It doesn't strike me as a very funny series. I mean, I say it's hypnotic. It mesmerizes. I don't know. I see little children. Even the movie, I tried to get the pacing of the show. It was never a very fast paced show, but there's something about that I think is right. It was right for the show. And so I did, when they were in the house, I tried to pace it the same as the show, besides shoot it the same, have it look the same. And
I was thinking that for the auditions, you must have had people smile a lot, since everybody in the Bradys has to smile all the time. Particularly, my favorite smiler in the movie was the guy who played Greg. So did you have them smile for the auditions?
Pretty much. I mean, what I had them do is everyone knew they were supposed to look like their respective Brady character. And I had the series playing on a television out in the waiting room. and I kept it running in a loop over and over again so that everyone that was out there would have to see some of the series. And I advised them to watch it before they came in, and as soon as they were there, if anybody came back for a callback, I sent them home with their little package of six shows to look at over and over and over again. I really thought that the voices were important, to get the voices right, and I don't know, I had this feeling that if kids who had seen reruns came to the movie, that they should feel immediately comfortable with the people who were playing. In other words, feel immediately that they're there with the Bradys, not with some imposters trying to be the Bradys. So having them look exactly the same was pretty important.
So, you know, Sherwood Schwartz, who was the creator of the Brady Bunch, also co-produced the movie. So did he draw
really?
The...
No, I mean that.
So did he draw the line on how much you could mock the
No,
characters?
He did. You have to understand Hollywood, or someone has to understand it. I certainly do not understand it. Sherwood Schwartz, I could count it on my hands how many times I met with Sherwood. It was not really a Sherwood Schwartz production in that he did not have control of the movie in any way. On the other hand, I would say this, that you know, I listened to Sherwood the few times that he did have something to say, and I didn't always follow his advice, but I listened.
What kind of advice did he give you?
Well, he had things that he thought were, you know, he was very intent on not on being careful of how we made fun of the Bradys. And he was nervous about Marcia having a sexually confused best friend. He was nervous about anything that looked like we were putting down the Bradys. And he often wanted to hold on to things that I didn't feel were as important. Once you get to that editing process, you know, there was about 40 minutes of this movie that ended up never in the movie.
So did you enjoy it?
I had a great time. I truly had a great time. And I say now, the thing that I really dread is that it'll be in print. I'll be Betty Thomas, parentheses, the Brady Bunch, for the rest of my life. I mean, as a director, as opposed to Betty Thomas, Hill Street Blues, Betty Thomas, Dream On. There's a number of things that would have been nice to have after my name now, to have the Brady Bunch. I don't know.
No, you will be a very Brady Betty Thomas.
There you have it.
You know, in some ways, I could say it's really lucky that you're directing now because there's so few roles for actresses over 35.
Yeah, my mother would say the same thing, but I don't know. I'm glad I took my moment in time and said what I really always wanted to do was direct, like everyone says, I suppose. But I was a visual artist from day one. I was a painter. I was a printmaker. I went to college in fine arts. I didn't ever think that I was going to be an actor, nor did I ever plan on it. And I had that wonderful side event in my life that lasted, you know, I don't know, 15 years. And I didn't know, once I was in it, I didn't know if it would ever end again. After Hill Street was the time to really make a jump, if I was going to make the jump. And I'm so happy I did it. I think you're right. Many of my friends are just, you know, devastated at what happens when you turn that big 4-0 and you're a woman and you're an actor.
And you're about 6 feet tall, so that might have been an impediment, too.
Well, it hasn't bothered Gina Davis.
Is she that tall?
Yeah, I think so. Huh. I was in a room with her once. We were both looking at each other pretty straight on. I don't know.
My guest is Betty Thomas. She's the director of the Brady Bunch movie. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Betty Thomas. You got your start, I think of a lot of our listeners will know you as an actress from your part on Hill Street Blues, in which you played Lucy Bates. Now, I've read about you that you knew how to use a gun before you got the part. Did that help in playing the role?
No, not at all. Didn't have anything to do with it. Most of the guys on the show, most of everyone on the show, did, you know, never saw a gun before in their lives, in their hands anyway. I mean, And everybody got minimal, you know, here's how you hold it, here's how you shoot it. Or we all had minimal instruction on what to do. So, no, it didn't help at all. It was meaningless. The only thing it did was it gave me a great respect for guns, which some people on the show did not have.
When you were playing Lucy Bates in Hill Street Blues, did you have a sense that this was a kind of particularly important role to a lot of women because there were so few women playing roles like cops on TV at the time?
I remember saying once, I don't represent all women, and I certainly don't represent all women police officers, so I basically just represent this character that was created by Stephen Bochco, and I hope I represent her to the best of my ability, and I hope that I include part of who I am in the character, which thereby makes her real, if nothing else, or gives her some reality base. And that's what I miss from female characters, is a base of reality, of something that I can relate to, some part of her that makes her feel, at least, or makes characters feel like they haven't been written by a man, which they usually have.
Well, your episodes were written by a man, weren't they?
Most of them. Uh-huh. Yes, most of them. Absolutely.
Were there things you had to change? Were there things that you said, this doesn't feel right? I don't think a woman would say this.
Very seldom.
There were good writers on that show.
There were excellent writers on the show. There was a female writer there for a while. I think her name was Karen Hall. And I think it was very difficult for her being the only female writer. They're a pretty male group of guys throwing footballs around and being guys. But there was one show where Lucy, it was a show where something was going on with an abortion clinic and there was a bombing or something. I mean, this was a long, long time ago. Interesting the way things haven't really changed much. And they had Lucy give this speech at one point where she, sort of a monologue, where she hinted at the fact that she felt it was a very personal choice whether you believed in it or didn't believe in it. The important thing was that it should be kept a private and personal choice. And it was so interesting that I that's the one time when I did want to talk to the writers, and David Milch had written that particular section of that episode, and I spoke with him, and he very courteously took all my notes and said, okay, let me think about it. And the next day he came back with a new scene and he had rewritten it based on what we had talked about. And I thought, how much more responsive could writers be? I mean, that was pretty much the way it was on Hill Street.
Are you still in touch with the people who also acted on Hill Street?
Well, I don't know if you noticed, but or you maybe didn't notice, but when I did Midnight Caller, I hired Ed Marinaro to play the abusive husband. And
Ed Marinaro had been your partner on Hill Street.
Right. And so, and recently, Eddie called me in to congratulate me on the success of the Brady Bunch, and so did Bruce Weitz, and so did Charlie Haid. And Greg Hoblit wrote me a letter, and we see each other every once in a while. We don't see each other every week. We don't hang out together, really, but I see Eddie once in a while, and Bruce and Charlie. And Charlie's a director now, so I do probably see Charlie more than anybody else.
Do you ever watch the reruns?
You know, I don't. I've seen them every once in a while. I know my mom watches them. And, I feel like Lucy went on with her career, and I went on with my career, and she's doing quite well. She's on TV all the time. And so am I. I'm doing well. I'm directing. And one thing she has under control is this aging thing. She looks very good for all these years.
She looks just like she used to.
She really does. Just about, anyway. I mean, I can tell a little bit that she's aged, but I've aged more than she has. I don't understand it.
Well, Betty Thomas, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Betty Thomas directed the Brady Bunch movie. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what's going on with the balanced budget vote in Washington?
Hi, Terry. There will not be a vote in the Senate on that amendment until at least Thursday, as the leadership tries to find some more support. In other stories, I will talk with one of the replacement players in training camp with the New York Mets. This fellow hit .440 for as third baseman in college. He has no professional experience, even though he told the Mets he did. Also, Ron Carlson, the writer, has some thoughts about being a replacement fan. We will update our shamrock growing project, trying for white blossoms by St. Patrick's Day, and a conversation about the singer Alison Krauss, nominated for a Grammy Award.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Everyone knows Ike Turner as the bad husband, the man who kept his wife Tina in fear. What everyone doesn't know is that Tina entered the picture rather late in Ike's career. Before she came along, Ike Turner's place in American pop music history was already secure. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says that was because of the record Rocket 88.
You've heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along.
Rocket 88 by Jackie Brenston and his Delta Cats on Chess is one of the candidates for the title of the first rock and roll record. Recorded in March 1951, it spent most of the summer of that year at the top of the rhythm and blues charts, and what powered it was the hard-driving piano played by Ike Turner. In fact, the Delta Cats didn't really exist. They were really the Kings of Rhythm, the band 20-year-old Ike had been leading in Clarksdale, Mississippi, his hometown, since he was 18. Early in 1951, B.B. King, at the time a popular radio personality in Memphis, spotted them playing a club and recommended the Kings of Rhythm to another important figure, Sam Phillips. Phillips had opened a studio in Memphis to provide recordings by local musicians to big-time R&B labels like Chess in Chicago and Modern in L.A. Rocket 88 had far-reaching consequences. Brenston got a big head and moved to Chicago. Ike Turner moved his band to West Memphis, Arkansas, across the Mississippi from Memphis, a hotbed of musical talent. And Sam Phillips, disgusted at having given away a number one record, decided to open his own label, Sun. Ike became a talent scout for Modern, and, armed with a portable tape recorder and a new Buick, recorded dozens of blues classics by B.B. King, Howlin' Wolf, Elmore James, and, occasionally, his own band. Ike loved rough vocalists like Dennis Binder, who recorded with the Kings of Rhythm on I Miss You So, or Eugene Fox.
Now something's going on that I can't sit. My baby leave home, nobody knows where she went. I hate to do it, but I guess I may. I'm going to do what the hoodoo say. Get some of your hair and boil it in a pot. Take some of your clothes, tie them in a knot. Put them in a snuff can, bury them under the steps. Then you wouldn't want, baby, nobody else. So,
slick, slick, baby, I've got my eyes on you. When I catch you, baby, no telling what I might do.
Hoodoo Say, you may notice, lacks a piano. That's because Ike had picked up the guitar. Ike and the band relocated to East St. Louis, Missouri, where they started abandoning blues and getting modern, as this 1958 record shows.
Oh, bugs come.
Let's run, don't let us drum.
Midnight.
Oh, bugs come.
Bone and hop.
Let's do the drum.
Can't miss.
Let's take a chance. Come and try.
Now here's why.
Girls will pass you by.
Too shy.
Boxtop featured as a backup vocalist a teenage girl named Little Annie, Annie Mae Bullock, who became Tina Turner. They made their first records together in 1960, and the partnership took off. You can read all about it in Tina's autobiography, and there's no doubt that Ike faded into the background. Still, he continued to make records, and as late as 1970, he was still playing good guitar, as well as reflecting about what had happened to him. It was too late. Tina had eclipsed him, and Ike Turner was on his way to becoming a forgotten legend.
Ed Ward is a freelance writer currently living in Berlin. The music he played has been reissued on the CD I Like Ike, The Best of Ike Turner, on Rhino Records. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Bob Alls, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Farrer, Straus, and Giroux, publisher of Laurie Garrett's The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance. This is NPR, National Public Radio.